Within your mind, there can be no such differentiation as this one is mine and that is another's, because you are the supreme absolute truth, the soul of all beings, always equipoised and enjoying transcendental happiness within yourself. Just like the heavenly desire tree, you bless all who properly worship you, granting their desired fruits in proportion to the service they render you. There is nothing wrong in this. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Your decision is perfect, O King, and thus your noble fame will spread to all the worlds, O tormentor of your enemies." "Indeed, my Lord, for the great sages, the forefathers, and the demigods, for our well-wishing friends, and indeed for all living beings, the performance of this King of Vedic sacrifices is desirable. First conquer all kings, bring the earth under your control, and collect all the required paraphernalia. Then execute this great sacrifice. These brothers of yours, O King, have taken birth as partial expansions of the demigods ruling various planets, and you are so self-controlled that you have conquered even me, who am unconquerable for those who cannot control their senses. No one in this world, even a demigod, what to speak of an earthly king, can defeat my devotee with his strength, beauty, fame, or riches." Shukadeva Goswami said, "Upon hearing these words sung by the Supreme Lord, King Yudhishthira became joyful, and his face blossomed like a lotus. Thus he sent forth his brothers, who were empowered with Lord Vishnu's potency, to conquer all directions. He sent Sahadev to the south with the Srinjayas, Nakula to the west with the Matsyas, Arjuna to the north with the Kekayas, and Bhima to the east with the Mudrikas. After defeating many kings with their prowess, these heroic brothers brought back abundant wealth for Yudhishthira Maharaj, who was intent on performing the sacrifice. When King Yudhishthira heard that Jarasandha remained undefeated, he set to pondering, and then the primeval lord, Hari, told him the means Uddhava had described for defeating Jarasandha. Thus, Bhimasen, Arjuna, and Krishna disguised themselves as Brahmins and went to Girivraja, where the son of Brihadratta was to be found. Disguised as Brahmins, the royal warriors approached Jarasandha at home during the appointed hour for receiving guests. They submitted their entreaty to that dutiful householder, who was especially respectful to the Brahminical class. Krishna, Arjuna, and Bhima said, "O King, know us to be needy guests who have come to you from afar. We wish all good unto you. Please grant us whatever we desire." "What can the tolerant not bear? What will the wicked not do? What will the generous not give in charity? And who will those of equal vision see as an outsider? He indeed is to be censured and pitied who, though able to do so, fails to achieve with his temporary body the lasting fame glorified by great saints. Harishchandra, Rantidev, Unchavriti Mudgala, Shibi, Bali, the legendary hunter and pigeon, and many others have attained the permanent by means of the impermanent." Shukadeva Goswami said, "From the sound of their voices, their physical stature, and the marks of bowstrings on their forearms, Jarasandha could tell that his guests were of the royal order. He began to think he had seen them somewhere before." Jarasandha thought, "These are surely members of the royal order dressed as Brahmins, but still I must grant their request for charity, even if they beg me for my own body. Indeed, the spotless glories of Bali Maharaj are heard throughout the world. Lord Vishnu, wishing to recover Indra's opulence from Bali, appeared before him in the guise of a Brahmin and made him fall from his powerful position. Though aware of the ruse and forbidden by his guru, Bali, king of the demons, still gave Vishnu the whole earth in charity. What is the use of an unqualified Kshatriya who goes on living but fails to gain everlasting glory by working with his perishable body for the benefit of Brahmins?" Thus making up his mind, the generous Jarasandha addressed Krishna, Arjuna, and Bhima. "O learned Brahmins, choose whatever you wish. I will give it to you, even if it is my own head." The Supreme Lord said, "O exalted King, give us battle in the form of a duel if you think it fitting. We are princes and have come to beg a fight. We have no other request to make of you. Over there is Bhima, son of Prita, and this is his brother Arjuna. Know me to be their maternal cousin, Krishna, your enemy." Thus challenged, Jarasandha laughed out loud and contemptuously said, "All right, you fools, I'll give you a fight. But I will not fight with you, Krishna, for you are a coward. Your strength abandoned you in the midst of battle, and you fled your own capital of Mathura to take shelter in the sea. As for this one, Arjuna, He is not as old as I, nor is he very strong. Since he is no match for me, he should not be the contender. Bhima, however, is as strong as I am." Having said this, Jarasandh offered Bhimasen a huge club, took up another himself, and went outside the city. The two heroes thus began battling each other on the level fighting grounds outside the city. Maddened with the fury of combat, they struck each other with their lightning bolt-like clubs. As they skillfully circled left and right, like actors dancing on a stage, the fight presented a magnificent spectacle. When Jarasandh's and Bhimasen's clubs loudly collided, O king, they sounded like the impact of the big tusks of two fighting elephants, or like the crash of a thunderbolt in a flashing electrical storm. They swung their clubs at each other with such speed and force that as the clubs struck their shoulders, hips, feet, hands, thighs, and collarbones, the weapons were crushed and broken like branches of arca trees with which two enraged elephants furiously attack each other. Their clubs thus ruined, those great heroes among men angrily pummeled each other with their iron-hard fists. As they slapped each other, the sound resembled the crash of elephants colliding or harsh thunderclaps. As they thus fought, this contest between opponents of equal training, strength, and stamina reached no conclusion. And so they kept on fighting, O king, without any let-up. They continued to fight for 27 days. At the end of each day's fighting, both lived at night as friends in Jarasandh's palace. Then, on the 28th day, Bhima told his maternal cousin, "Madhava, I cannot defeat Jarasandh in battle." Lord Krishna knew the secret of his enemy Jarasandh's birth and death, and also how he had been given life by the demoness Jara. Considering all this, Lord Krishna imparted his special power to Bhima. Having determined how to kill the enemy, that lord of infallible vision made a sign to Bhima by tearing in half a small branch of a tree. Understanding this sign, mighty Bhima, the best of fighters, seized his opponent by the feet and threw him to the ground. Bhima pressed down on one leg with his foot while grabbing Jarasandh's other leg in his hands, and just as a great elephant might break the branch of a tree, Bhima tore Jarasandh apart from the anus upward. The king's subjects then saw him lying in two separate pieces, each with a single leg, thigh, testicle, hip, shoulder, arm, eye, eyebrow, and ear, and with half a back and chest. With the death of the Lord of Magadha, a great cry of lamentation arose, while Arjuna and Krishna congratulated Bhima by embracing him. The immeasurable Supreme Personality of Godhead, the sustainer and benefactor of all living beings, coronated Jarasandh's son, Sahadev, as the new ruler of the Magadhas. The Lord then freed all the kings Jarasandh had imprisoned. Chapter 73. Lord Krishna blesses the liberated kings. Shukadev Goswami said, "Jarasandh had defeated 20,800 kings in combat and thrown them into prison. As these kings emerged from the Giridroni fortress, they appeared dirty and shabbily dressed. They were emaciated by hunger, their faces were dried up, and they were greatly weakened by their long imprisonment. The kings then beheld the Lord before them. His complexion was dark blue like the color of a cloud, and he wore a yellow silk garment. He was distinguished by the Srivats mark on his chest, his four mighty arms, the pinkish hue of his eyes, which resembled the whirl of a lotus, his lovely, cheerful face, his gleaming Makara earrings, and the lotus, club, conch shell, and disc in his hands. A helmet, a jeweled necklace, a golden belt, and golden bracelets and armlets decorated his form, and on his neck he wore both the brilliant, precious Kaustubha gem and a garland of forest flowers. The kings seemed to drink his beauty with their eyes, lick him with their tongues, relish his fragrance with their nostrils, and embrace him with their arms. Their past sins now eradicated, the kings all bowed down to Lord Hari, placing their heads at his feet. The ecstasy of beholding Lord Krishna having dispelled the weariness of their imprisonment, the kings stood with joined palms and offered words of praise to that supreme master of the senses. The king said, "Obeisances to you, O Lord of the ruling demigods, O destroyer of your surrendered devotees' distress. Since we have surrendered to you, O inexhaustible Krishna, please save us from this terrible material life which has made us so despondent. O Master Madhusudan, we do not blame this king of Magadha, since it is actually by your mercy that kings fall from their royal position, O Almighty Lord. Infatuated with his opulence and ruling power, a king loses all self-restraint and cannot obtain his true welfare. Thus bewildered by your illusory energy, he imagines his temporary assets to be permanent. Just as men of childish intelligence consider a mirage in the desert to be a pond of water, so those who are irrational look upon the illusory transformations of Maya as substantial. Previously, blinded by the intoxication of riches, we wanted to conquer this earth, and thus we fought one another to achieve victory, mercilessly harassing our own subjects. We arrogantly disregarded you, O Lord, who stood before us as death. But now, O Krishna, that powerful form of yours called time, moving mysteriously and irresistibly, has deprived us of our opulences. Now that you have mercifully destroyed our pride, we beg simply to remember your lotus feet. Never again will we hanker for a mirage-like kingdom, a kingdom that must be slavishly served by this mortal body, which is simply a source of disease and suffering, and which is declining at every moment. Nor, O Almighty Lord, will we hanker to enjoy the heavenly fruits of pious work in the next life, since the promise of such rewards is simply an empty enticement for the ears. Please tell us how we may constantly remember your lotus feet, though we continue in the cycle of birth and death in this world. Again and again we offer our obeisances unto Lord Krishna, Hari, the son of Vasudev. That supreme soul, Govinda, vanquishes the suffering of all who surrender to him. Shukadev Goswami said, "Thus the kings, now freed from bondage, glorified the Supreme Lord. Then, my dear Parikshit, that merciful bestower of shelter spoke to them in a gentle voice. From now on, my dear kings, you will have firm devotion to me, the Supreme Self and the Lord of all that be. I assure you this will come to pass just as you desire. Fortunately, you have come to the proper conclusion, my dear kings, and what you have spoken is true. I can see that human beings' lack of self-restraint, which arises from their intoxication with opulence and power, simply leads to madness. Haihaya, Nahusha, Vena, Ravana, Naraka, and many other rulers of demigods, men, and demons fell from their elevated positions because of infatuation with material opulence. Understanding that this material body and everything connected with it have a beginning and an end, worship me by Vedic sacrifices, and with clear intelligence protect your subjects in accordance with the principles of religion. As you live your lives, begetting generations of progeny and encountering happiness and distress, birth and death, always keep your minds fixed on me. Be detached from the body and everything connected to it. Remaining self-satisfied, steadfastly keep your vows while concentrating your minds fully on me. In this way, you will ultimately attain me, the Supreme Absolute Truth." Shukadev Goswami said, "Having thus instructed the kings, Lord Krishna, the supreme master of all the worlds, engaged male and female servants in bathing and grooming them. The Lord then had King Sahadev honor them with offerings of clothing, jewelry, garlands, and sandalwood paste, all suitable for royalty. After they had been properly bathed and adorned, Lord Krishna saw to it that they dined on excellent food. He also presented them with various items befitting the pleasure of kings, such as betel nut. Honored by Lord Mukunda and freed from tribulation, the kings shone splendidly, their earrings gleaming, just as the moon and other celestial bodies shine brilliantly in the sky at the end of the rainy season. Then the Lord arranged for the kings to be seated on chariots drawn by fine horses and adorned with jewels and gold. And pleasing them with gracious words, he sent them off to their own kingdoms. Thus liberated from all difficulty by Krishna, the greatest of personalities, the kings departed. And as they went, they thought only of him, the Lord of the universe, and of his wonderful deeds. The kings told their ministers and other associates what the personality of Godhead had done, and they diligently carried out the orders he had imparted to them. Having arranged for Bhimasen to kill Jarasandh, Lord Keshava accepted worship from King Sahadev and then departed with the two sons of Prita. When they arrived at Indraprastha, the victorious heroes blew their conch shells, bringing joy to their well-wishing friends and sorrow to their enemies. The residents of Indraprastha were very pleased to hear that sound, for they understood that now the king of Magadha had been put to rest. King Yudhisthira felt that his desires were now fulfilled. Bhima, Arjuna, and Janardhan offered their respects to the king and informed him fully about what they had done. Upon hearing their account of the great favor Lord Kesava had mercifully shown him, King Yudhisthira shed tears of ecstasy. He felt such love that he could not say anything. Chapter 74, The Deliverance of Shishupal at the Rajasuya Sacrifice. Shukadev Goswami said, "Having thus heard of the killing of Jarasandh and also of Almighty Krishna's wonderful power, King Yudhisthira addressed the Lord as follows with great pleasure. All the exalted spiritual masters of the three worlds, together with the inhabitants and rulers of the various planets, carry on their heads your command, which is rarely obtained. That you, the lotus-eyed Supreme Lord, accept the orders of wretched fools who presume themselves rulers is a great pretense on your part, O all-pervading one. But of course, the power of the absolute truth, the Supreme Soul, the primeval one without a second, is neither increased nor diminished by his activities, any more than the sun's power is by its movements. O unconquerable Madhava, even your devotees make no distinctions of I and mine, you and yours, for this is the perverted mentality of animals." Having said this, King Yudhisthira waited until the proper time for the sacrifice was at hand. Then, with Lord Krishna's permission, he selected suitable priests, all expert authorities on the Vedas, to execute the sacrifice. He selected Krishna Dvaipayana, Bharadvaj, Sumantu, Gautama, and Asita, along with Vasishta, Javana, Kanva, Maitreya, Kavasha, and Trita. He also selected Vishvamitra, Vamadev, Sumati, Jaimini, Kratu, Pila, and Parashara, as well as Garga, Vaishampayana, Atharva, Kashyapa, Daumya, Rama of the Bhargavas, Asuri, Vitihotra, Madhuchanda, Virasena, and Akutavarna. O King, others who were invited included Drona, Bhishma, Kripa, Dhritarashtra with his sons, the wise Vidura, and many other Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras, all eager to witness the sacrifice. Indeed, all the kings came there with their entourages. The Brahmin priests then plowed the sacrificial ground with golden plowshares and initiated King Yudhisthira for the sacrifice in accordance with the traditions set down by standard authorities. The utensils used in the sacrifice were made of gold, just as in the ancient Rajasuya performed by Lord Varuna. Indra, Brahma, Shiva, and many other planetary rulers, the Siddhas and Gandharvas with their entourage, the Vidyadharas, great serpents, sages, yakshas, rakshasas, celestial birds, kinnaras, charanas, and earthly kings, all were invited, and indeed they all came from every direction to the Rajasuya sacrifice of King Yudhisthira, the son of Pandu. They were not in the least astonished to see the opulence of the sacrifice, since it was quite appropriate for the devotee of Lord Krishna. The priests, as powerful as gods, performed the Rajasuya sacrifice for King Yudhisthira in accordance with the Vedic injunctions, just as the demigods had previously performed it for Varuna. On the day of extracting the soma juice, King Yudhisthira properly and very attentively worshipped the priests and the most exalted personalities of the assembly. The members of the assembly then pondered over who among them should be worshipped first, but since there were many personalities qualified for this honor, they were unable to decide. Finally, Sahadev spoke up. "Certainly it is Achyuta, the Supreme Personality of Godhead and Chief of the Yadavas, who deserves the highest position. In truth, he himself comprises all the demigods worshipped in the sacrifice, along with such aspects of the worship as the sacred place, the time, and the paraphernalia. This entire universe is founded upon him, as are the great sacrificial performances with their sacred fires, oblations, and mantras. Sankhya and Yoga both aim toward him, the one without a second. O assembly members, that unborn Lord, relying solely on himself, creates, maintains, and destroys this cosmos by his personal energies, and thus the existence of this universe depends on him alone. He creates the many activities of this world, and thus, by his grace, the whole world endeavors for the ideals of religiosity, economic development, sense gratification, and liberation. Therefore, we should give the highest honor to Krishna, the Supreme Lord. If we do so, we will be honoring all living beings and also our own selves. Anyone who wishes the honor he gives to be reciprocated infinitely should honor Krishna, the perfectly peaceful and perfectly complete soul of all beings, the Supreme Lord, who views nothing as separate from himself. Having said this, Sahadev, who understood Lord Krishna's powers, fell silent. And having heard his words, all the saintly persons present congratulated him, exclaiming, "Excellent! Excellent!" The king was delighted to hear this pronouncement of the Brahmins, from which he understood the mood of the entire assembly. Overwhelmed with love, he fully worshipped Lord Krishna, the master of the senses. After bathing Lord Krishna's feet, Maharaj Yudhisthira joyfully sprinkled the water upon his own head, and then upon the heads of his wife, brothers, other family members, and ministers. That water purifies the whole world. As he honored the Lord with presentations of yellow silken garments and precious jeweled ornaments, the king's tear-filled eyes prevented him from looking directly at the Lord. When they saw Lord Krishna thus honored, nearly all who were present joined their palms reverentially, exclaiming, "Obeisances to you! All victory to you!" And then they bowed down to him. Flowers rained down from above. The intolerant son of Dhammaghosh became infuriated upon hearing the glorification of Lord Krishna's transcendental qualities. He stood up from his seat, and angrily waving his arms, he fearlessly spoke to the entire assembly the following harsh words against the Supreme Lord. "The statement of the Vedas that time is the unavoidable controller of all has indeed been proven true, since the intelligence of wise elders has now become diverted by the words of a mere boy. O leaders of the assembly, you know best who is a fit candidate for being honored. Therefore, you should not heed the words of a child when he claims that Krishna deserves to be worshipped. How can you pass over the most exalted members of this assembly, topmost sages dedicated to the absolute truth, endowed with powers of austerity, divine insight, and strict adherence to severe vows, sanctified by knowledge and worshipped even by the rulers of the universe? How does this coward boy, the disgrace of his family, deserve your worship, any more than a crow deserves to eat the sacred puttadasha rice cake? How does one who follows no principles of the social and spiritual orders or of family ethics, who has been excluded from all religious duties, who behaves whimsically and who has no good qualities, how does such a person deserve to be worshipped? Yayati cursed the dynasty of these Yadavas, and ever since then they have been ostracized by honest men and addicted to liquor. How then does Krishna deserve to be worshipped? These Yadavas have abandoned the holy lands inhabited by saintly sages and have instead taken shelter of a fortress in the sea, a place where no brahminical principles are observed. There, just like thieves, they harass their subjects." Bereft of all good fortune, Shishupal spoke these and other insults. But the Supreme Lord said nothing, just as a lion ignores a jackal's cry. Upon hearing such intolerable blasphemy of the Lord, several members of the assembly covered their ears and walked out, angrily cursing the king of Chedi. Anyone who fails to immediately leave the place where he hears criticism of the Supreme Lord or his faithful devotee will certainly fall down, bereft of his pious credit. Then the sons of Pandu became furious, and together with the warriors of the Matsya, Kaikeya, and Srinjaya clans, they rose up from their seats with weapons poised, ready to kill Shishupal. Undaunted, Shishupal then took up his sword and shield in the midst of all the assembled kings, and he hurled insults at those who sided with Krishna. At that point, the Supreme Lord stood up and checked his devotees. He then angrily sent forth his razor-sharp disc and severed the head of his enemy as he was attacking. When Shishupal was thus killed, a great roar and howl went up from the crowd. Taking advantage of that disturbance, the few kings who were supporters of Shishupal quickly left the assembly out of fear for their lives. An effulgent light rose from Shishupal's body, and as everyone watched, entered Lord Krishna just like a meteor falling from the sky to the earth. Obsessed with hatred of Lord Krishna throughout three lifetimes, Shishupal attained the Lord's transcendental nature. Indeed, one's consciousness determines one's future birth. King Yudhisthira gave generous gifts to the sacrificial priests and the members of the assembly, properly honoring them all in the manner prescribed by the Vedas. He then took the Avabrita bath. Thus Sri Krishna, the Lord of all masters of mystic yoga, saw to the successful execution of this great sacrifice on behalf of King Yudhisthira. Afterwards, the Lord stayed with his intimate friends for a few months at their earnest request. Then the Lord, the son of Devaki, took the reluctant permission of the king and returned to his capital with his wives and ministers. I have already described to you in detail the history of the two residents of Vaikuntha who had to undergo repeated births in the material world because of being cursed by Brahmins. Purified in the final of a Avavritya ritual, which marked the successful completion of the Rajasuya sacrifice, King Yudhisthira shone among the assembled Brahmins and Kshatriyas like the king of the demigods himself. The demigods, humans, and residents of intermediate heavens, all properly honored by the king, happily set off for their respective domains while singing the praises of Lord Krishna and the great sacrifice. All were satisfied except sinful Duryodhana, the personification of the age of quarrel and the disease of the Kuru dynasty. He could not bear to see the flourishing opulence of the son of Pandu. One who recites these activities of Lord Vishnu, including the killing of Shishupal, the deliverance of the kings, and the performance of the Rajasuya sacrifice, is freed from all sins. Chapter 75, Duryodhana Humiliated. King Parikshit said, O Brahman, according to what I have heard from you, all the assembled kings, sages, and demigods were delighted to see the wonderful festivities of King Yudhisthira's Rajasuya sacrifice, with the sole exception of Duryodhana. Please tell me why this was so, my lord. Sri Badarayani said, At the Rajasuya sacrifice of your saintly grandfather, his family members, bound by their love for him, engaged themselves in humble services on his behalf. Bhima supervised the kitchen. Duryodhana looked after the treasury, while Sahadev respectfully greeted the arriving guests. Nakula procured needed items. Arjuna attended the respectable elders, and Krishna washed everyone's feet, while Draupadi served food and generous Karna gave out the gifts. Many others, such as Yuyudhan, Vikarna, Hardikya, Vidura, Bhuri Shrava, and other sons of Balika, and Santardhan, similarly volunteered for various duties during the elaborate sacrifice. They did so because of their eagerness to please Maharaj Yudhisthira, O best of kings. After the priests, the prominent delegates, the greatly learned saints, and the king's most intimate well-wishers had all been properly honored with pleasing words, auspicious offerings, and various gifts as remuneration, and after the king of Chedi had entered the lotus feet of the lord of the Satvatas, the Avavrita bath was performed in the divine river Yamuna. During the Avavrita celebration, the music of many kinds of instruments resounded, including mridangas, conchels, panavas, tundaris, kettle drums, and gomukha horns. Female dancers danced with great joy, and choruses sang, while the loud vibrations of veenas, flutes, and hand cymbals reached all the way to the heavenly regions. All the kings, wearing gold necklaces, then set off for the Yamuna. They had flags and banners of various colors and were accompanied by infantrymen and well-adorned soldiers riding lordly elephants, chariots, and horses. The massed armies of the Yadus, Srinjayas, Kambojas, Kurus, Kekayas, and Koshalas made the earth tremble as they followed Yudhisthira Maharaj, the performer of the sacrifice, in procession. The assembled officials, the priests, and the other excellent Brahmins resoundingly vibrated Vedic mantras, while the demigods, divine sages, pitas, and gandharvas sang praises and rained down flowers. Men and women, all adorned with sandalwood paste, flower garlands, jewelry, and fine clothing, sported by smearing and sprinkling one another with various liquids. The men smeared the courtesans with plentiful oil, yogurt, perfumed water, turmeric, and kumkum powder, and the courtesans playfully smeared the men with the same substances. Surrounded by guards, King Yudhisthira's queens came out on their chariots to see the fun, just as the demigods' wives appeared in the sky in celestial airplanes. As maternal cousins and intimate friends sprinkled the queens with liquids, the ladies' faces bloomed with shy smiles, enhancing the queen's splendid beauty. As the queens squirted water from syringes at their brothers-in-law and other male companions, their own garments became drenched, revealing their arms, breasts, thighs, and waists. In their excitement, the flowers fell from their loosened braids. By these charming pastimes, they agitated those with contaminated consciousness. The emperor, mounted upon his chariot drawn by excellent horses wearing golden collars, appeared splendid in the company of his wives, just like the brilliant Rajasuya sacrifice surrounded by its various rituals. The priests led the king through the execution of the final rituals of Patni Sanyaja and Avavritya. Then they had him and Queen Draupadi sip water for purification and bathe in the Ganges. The kettle drums of the gods resounded, along with those of human beings. Demigods, sages, forefathers, and humans all poured down showers of flowers. All the citizens belonging to the various orders of Varna and Ashram then bathed in that place, where even the most grievous sinner can immediately be freed from all sinful reactions. Next, the king put on new silken garments and adorned himself with fine jewelry. He then honored the priests, assembly officials, learned Brahmins, and other guests by presenting them with ornaments and clothing. In various ways, King Yudhisthir, who had totally dedicated his life to Lord Narayan, continuously honored his relatives, his immediate family, the other kings, his friends and well-wishers, and all others present as well. All the men there shone like demigods. They were adorned with jeweled earrings, flower garlands, turbans, waistcoats, silk dhotis, and valuable pearl necklaces. The lovely faces of the women were beautified by their matched earrings and locks of hair, and they all wore golden belts. Then the highly cultured priests, the great Vedic authorities who had served as sacrificial witnesses, the specially invited kings, the Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, demigods, sages, forefathers, and mystic spirits, and the chief planetary rulers and their followers, all of them, having been worshipped by King Yudhisthir, took his permission and departed, each for his own abode. As they all glorified the wonderful Rajasuya Jagya performed by that great saintly king and servant of Lord Hari, they were not satiated, just as an ordinary man is never satiated when drinking nectar. At that time, King Yudhisthir stopped a number of his friends, immediate family members, and other relatives from departing, among them Lord Krishna. Out of love, Yudhisthir could not let them go, for he felt the pain of imminent separation. My dear Parikshit, the Supreme Lord remained there for some time to please the king, after first sending Samba and the other Yadu heroes back to Dwarka. Thus King Yudhisthir, the son of Dharma, was at last relieved of his burning ambition, having by the grace of Lord Krishna successfully crossed the vast and formidable ocean of his desires. One day, Duryodhana, while observing the riches of King Yudhisthir's palace, felt greatly disturbed by the magnificence of both the Rajasuya sacrifice and its performer, the king, whose life and soul was Lord Achyuta. In that palace, all the collected opulences of the kings of men, demons, and gods were brilliantly manifest, having been brought there by the cosmic inventor, Mayadhanava. With those riches, Draupadi served her husbands, and Duryodhana, the prince of the Kurus, lamented because he was very much attracted to her. Lord Krishna's thousands of queens were also staying in the palace. Their feet moved slowly, weighed down by their hips, and the bells on their feet tinkled charmingly. Their waists were very slender, the kumkum from their breasts reddened their pearl necklaces, and their swaying earrings and flowing locks of hair enhanced the exquisite beauty of their faces. It so happened that Emperor Yudhisthir, the son of Dharma, was sitting just like Indra on a golden throne in the assembly hall built by Mayadhanava. Present with him were his attendants and family members, and also Lord Krishna, his special eye. Displaying the opulences of Brahma himself, King Yudhisthir was being praised by the court poets. Proud Duryodhana, holding a sword in his hand and wearing a crown and necklace, angrily went into the palace in the company of his brothers, insulting the doorkeepers as he entered. Bewildered by the illusions created through Mayadhanava's magic, Duryodhana mistook the solid floor for water and lifted the end of his garment, and elsewhere he fell into the water, mistaking it for the solid floor. My dear Parikshit, Bhima laughed to see this, and so did the women, kings, and others. King Yudhisthir tried to stop them, but Lord Krishna showed his approval. Humiliated and burning with anger, Duryodhana turned his face down, left without uttering a word, and went back to Hastinapur. The saintly persons present loudly cried out, "Alas, alas!" And King Yudhisthir was somewhat saddened. But the Supreme Lord, whose mere glance had bewildered Duryodhana, remained silent, for his intention was to remove the burden of the earth. I have now replied to your question, O King, concerning why Duryodhana was dissatisfied on the occasion of the great Rajasuya sacrifice. Chapter 76, The Battle Between Shalva and the Vrishnis. Shukadev Goswami said, "Now please hear, O King, another wondrous deed performed by Lord Krishna, who appeared in his human-like body to enjoy transcendental pastimes. Hear how he killed the master of Saubha." Shalva was a friend of Shishupal's, when he attended the wedding of Rukmini, the Yadu warriors defeated him in battle, along with Jarasandh and the other kings. Shalva swore in the presence of all the kings, I will rid the earth of Yadavas. Just see my prowess. Having thus made his vow, the foolish king proceeded to worship Lord Shiva as his deity by eating a handful of dust each day and nothing more. The great Lord Shiva is known as he who is quickly pleased, yet only at the end of a whole year did he gratify Shalva, who had approached him for shelter, by offering him a choice of benedictions. Shalva chose a vehicle that could be destroyed by neither demigods, demons, humans, Gandharvas, Urugas, nor Rakshasas, that could travel anywhere he wished to go, and that would terrify the Vrishnis. Lord Shiva said, So be it. On his order, Mayadhanava, who conquers his enemy's cities, constructed a flying iron city named Sauba and presented it to Shalva. This unassailable vehicle was filled with darkness and could go anywhere. Upon obtaining it, Shalva went to Dwaraka, remembering the Vrishni's enmity toward him. Shalva besieged the city with a large army, decimating the outlying parks and gardens, the mansions along with their observatories, towering gateways and surrounding walls, and also the public recreational areas. From his excellent airship, he threw down a torrent of weapons, including stones, tree trunks, thunderbolts, snakes, and hailstones. A fierce whirlwind arose and blanketed all directions with dust. Thus terribly tormented by the airship Sauva, Lord Krishna's city had no peace, just like the earth when it was attacked by the three aerial cities of the demons. Seeing his subjects so harassed, the glorious and heroic Lord Pradyumna told them, Do not fear, and mounted his chariot. The chief commanders of the chariot warriors, Satyaki, Charudeshna, Samba, Akrura, and his younger brothers, along with Hardikya, Banuvinda, Gada, Shuka, and Sarana, went out of the city with many other eminent bowmen, all girded in armor and protected by contingents of soldiers riding on chariots, elephants, and horses, and also by companies of infantry. A tumultuous, hair-raising battle then commenced between Shalva's forces and the Yadus. It equaled the great battles between the demons and the demigods. With his divine weapons, Pradyumna instantly destroyed all of Shalva's magic illusions, in the same way that the warm rays of the sun dissipate the darkness of night. Lord Pradyumna's arrows all had gold shafts, iron heads, and perfectly smooth joints. With 25 of them, he struck down Shalva's commander-in-chief, Duman, and with 100 he struck Shalva himself. Then he pierced Shalva's officers with one arrow each, his chariot drivers with 10 arrows each, and his horses and other carriers with 3 arrows each. When they saw the glorious Pradyumna perform that amazing and mighty feat, all the soldiers on both sides praised him. At one moment, the magic airship built by Mayadhanava appeared in many identical forms, and the next moment it was again only one. Sometimes it was visible, and sometimes not. Thus Shalva's opponents could never be sure where it was. From one moment to the next, the Sauba airship appeared on the earth, in the sky, on a mountain peak, or in the water. Like a whirling, flaming baton, it never remained in any one place. Wherever Shalva appeared with his Sauba ship and his army, there the Yadu commanders would shoot their arrows. Shalva became bewildered upon seeing his army and aerial city thus harassed by his enemy's arrows, which struck like fire and the sun, and were as intolerable as snake venom. Because the heroes of the Vrishni clan were eager for victory in this world and the next, they did not abandon their assigned posts on the battlefield, even though the downpour of weapons hurled by Shalva's commanders tormented them. Shalva's minister Duman, previously wounded by Sri Pradyumna, now ran up to him and, roaring loudly, struck him with his club of black steel. Pradyumna's driver, the son of Dwaraka, thought that his valiant master's chest had been shattered by the club. Knowing well his religious duty, he removed Pradyumna from the battlefield. Quickly regaining consciousness, Lord Krishna's son Pradyumna said to his charioteer, O driver, this is abominable for me to have been removed from the battlefield. Except for me, no one born in the Yadu dynasty has ever been known to abandon the battlefield. My reputation has now been stained by a driver who thinks like a eunuch. What will I say to my fathers, Rama and Keshava, when I return to them after having simply fled the battle? What can I tell them that will befit my honor? Certainly my sisters-in-law will laugh at me and say, O hero, tell us how in the world your enemies turned you into such a coward in battle. The driver replied, O long-lived one, I have done this knowing full well my prescribed duty. O my lord, the chariot driver must protect the master of the chariot when he is in danger, and the master must also protect his driver. With this rule in mind, I removed you from the battlefield, since you had been struck unconscious by your enemy's club, and I thought you were seriously injured. Chapter 77. Lord Krishna slays the demon Shalva. Shukadeva Goswami said, after refreshing himself with water, putting on his armor, and picking up his bow, Lord Pradyumna told his driver, take me back to where the hero Duman is standing. In Pradyumna's absence, Duman had been devastating his army, but now Pradyumna counterattacked Duman and, smiling, pierced him with 8 Naracha arrows. With 4 of these arrows, he struck Duman's 4 horses, with 1 arrow, his driver, with 2 more arrows, his bow and chariot flag, and with the last arrow, Duman's head. Gada, Satyaki, Samba, and others began killing Shalva's army, and thus all the soldiers inside the airship began falling into the ocean, their necks severed. As the Yadus and Shalva's followers thus went on attacking one another, the tumultuous, fearsome battle continued for 27 days and nights. Invited by Yudhisthira, the son of Dharma, Lord Krishna had gone to Indraprastha. Now that the Rajasuya sacrifice had been completed and Shishupal killed, the Lord began to see inauspicious omens. So he took leave of the Kuru elders and the great sages, and also of Prita and her sons, and returned to Dwaraka. The Lord said to himself, because I have come here with my respected elder brother, kings partial to Shishupal may well be attacking my capital city. After Krishna arrived at Dwaraka and saw how his people were threatened with destruction, and also saw Shalva and his Sauva airship, Lord Keshava arranged for the city's defense and then addressed Dwaraka as follows. O driver, quickly take my chariot near Shalva. This lord of Sauva is a powerful magician. Don't let him bewilder you. Thus ordered, Dwaraka took command of the lord's chariot and drove forth. As the chariot entered the battlefield, everyone there, both friend and foe, caught sight of the emblem of Garuda. When Shalva, the master of a decimated army, saw Lord Krishna approaching, he hurled his spear at the Lord's charioteer. The spear roared frighteningly as it flew across the battlefield. Shalva's hurtling spear lit up the whole sky like a mighty meteor, but Lord Krishna tore the great weapon into hundreds of pieces with his arrows. Krishna then pierced Shalva with 16 arrows and struck the Sauva airship with a deluge of arrows as it darted about the sky. Firing his arrows, the Lord appeared like the sun flooding the heavens with its rays. Shalva then managed to strike Lord Krishna's left arm, which held his bow Shanga, and amazingly, Shanga fell from his hand. Those who witnessed this all cried out in dismay. Then the master of Sauva roared loudly and addressed Lord Janardhan. You fool! Because in our presence you kidnapped the bride of our friend Shishupal, your own cousin, and because you later murdered him in the sacred assembly while he was inattentive, today with my sharp arrows I will send you to the land of no return. Though you think yourself invincible, I will kill you now if you dare stand before me. The Supreme Lord said, O dullard, you boast in vain, since you failed to see death standing near you. Real heroes do not talk much, but rather show their prowess in action. Having said this, the furious lord swung his club with frightening power and speed and hit Shalva on the collarbone, making him tremble and vomit blood. But as soon as Lord Krishna withdrew his club, Shalva disappeared from sight, and a moment later a man approached the lord. Bowing his head down to him, he announced, Devaki has sent me, and sobbing, he spoke the following words, O Krishna, Krishna, mighty armed one, who are so affectionate to your parents! Shalva has seized your father and taken him away, as a butcher leads an animal to slaughter. When he heard this disturbing news, Krishna, who was playing the role of a mortal man, showed sorrow and compassion, and out of love for his parents, he spoke the following words like an ordinary conditioned soul. Balaram is ever vigilant, and no demigod or demon can defeat him. So how could this insignificant Shalva defeat him and abduct my father? Indeed, fate is all-powerful. After Govinda spoke these words, the master of Sauva again appeared, apparently leading Vasudeva before the Lord. Shalva then spoke as follows. Here is your dear father, who begot you and for whose sake you are living in this world. I shall now kill him before your very eyes. Save him if you can, weakling. After he had mocked the Lord in this way, the magician Shalva appeared to cut off Vasudeva's head with his sword. Taking the head with him, he entered the Sauba vehicle, which was hovering in the sky. By nature, Lord Krishna is full in knowledge, and he possesses unlimited powers of perception. Yet, for a moment, out of great affection for his loved ones, he remained absorbed in the mood of an ordinary human being. He soon recalled, however, that this was all a demoniac illusion engineered by Maya Danava and employed by Shalva. Now alert to the actual situation, Lord Achyuta saw before him on the battlefield neither the messenger nor his father's body. It was as if he had awakened from a dream. Seeing his enemy flying above him in his Sauba plane, the Lord then prepared to kill him. Such is the account given by some sages, O wise king. But those who speak in this illogical way are contradicting themselves, having forgotten their own previous statements. How can lamentation, bewilderment, material affection, or fear, all born out of ignorance, be ascribed to the infinite Supreme Lord, whose perception, knowledge, and power are all similarly infinite? By virtue of self-realization fortified by service rendered to his feet, devotees of the Lord dispel the bodily concept of life, which has bewildered the soul since time immemorial. Thus they attain eternal glory in his personal association. How, then, can that supreme truth, the destination of all genuine saints, be subject to illusion? While Shalva continued to hurl torrents of weapons at him with great force, Lord Krishna, whose prowess never fails, shot his arrows at Shalva, wounding him and shattering his armor, bow, and crest jewel. Then, with his club, the Lord smashed his enemy's Sauba airship. Shattered into thousands of pieces by Lord Krishna's club, the Sauba airship plummeted into the water. Shalva abandoned it, stationed himself on the ground, took up his club, and rushed toward Lord Krishna. As Shalva rushed at him, the Lord shot a bala dart and cut off his arm that held the club. Having finally decided to kill Shalva, Krishna then raised his Sudarshan disc weapon, which resembled the sun at the time of universal annihilation. The brilliantly shining Lord appeared like the easternmost mountain bearing the rising sun. Employing his disc, Lord Hari removed that great magician's head with its earrings and crown, just as Purandara had used his thunderbolt to cut off Vritra's head. Seeing this, all of Shalva's followers cried out, "Alas! Alas!" With the sinful Shalva now dead and his Sauba airship destroyed, the heavens resounded with kettle drums played by groups of demigods. Then Dantavakra, wanting to avenge the death of his friends, furiously attacked the Lord. Chapter 78, The Killing of Dantavakra, Vidurata, and Romaharshan. Shukadev Goswami said, acting out of friendship for Shishupal, Shalva, and Poundrika, who had passed on to the next world, the wicked Dantavakra appeared on the battlefield in a great rage, O king. All alone, on foot, and wielding a club in his hand, the mighty warrior shook the earth with his footsteps. Seeing Dantavakra approach, Lord Krishna quickly picked up his club, jumped down from his chariot, and stopped his advancing opponent just as the shore holds back the ocean. Raising his club, the reckless king of Karusha said to Lord Mukunda, "What luck! What luck to have you come before me today! You are our maternal cousin, Krishna, but you committed violence against my friends, and now you want to kill me also. Therefore, fool, I will kill you with my thunderbolt club. Then, O unintelligent one, I who am obliged to my friends will have repaid my debt to them by killing you, my enemy disguised as a relative, who are like a disease within my body." Thus trying to harass Lord Krishna with harsh words, as one might trick an elephant with sharp goads, Dantavakra struck the Lord on the head with his club and roared like a lion. Although hit by Dantavakra's club, Lord Krishna, the deliverer of the Yadus, did not budge from his place on the battlefield. Rather, with his massive Komadiki club, the Lord struck Dantavakra in the middle of his chest. His heart shattered by the club's blow, Dantavakra vomited blood and fell lifeless to the ground, his hair disheveled and his arms and legs sprawling. A most subtle and wondrous spark of light then rose from the demon's body and entered Lord Krishna while everyone looked on, just as when Shishupal was killed. But then Dantavakra's brother Vidurata, immersed in sorrow over his brother's death, came forward breathing heavily, sword and shield in hand. He wanted to kill the Lord. As Vidurata fell upon him, Lord Krishna used his razor-edged Sudarshan disc to remove his head, complete with its helmet and earrings. Having thus destroyed Shalva and his Salva airship, along with Dantavakra and his younger brother, all of whom were invincible before any other opponent, the Lord was praised by demigods, human beings, and great sages, by Siddhas, Gandharvas, Vijadaras, and Mahoragas, and also by Apsaras, Pitas, Yakshas, Kinnaras, and Charanas. As they sang his glories and showered him with flowers, the Supreme Lord entered his festively decorated capital city in the company of the most eminent Vrishnis. Thus Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the master of all mystic power and Lord of the universe, is ever victorious. Only those of beastly vision think he sometimes suffers defeat. Lord Balaram then heard that the Kurus were preparing for war with the Pandavas. Being neutral, he departed on the pretext of going to bathe in holy places. After bathing at Prabhas and honoring the demigods, sages, forefathers, and prominent human beings, he went in the company of Brahmins to the portion of the Saraswati that flows inland. Lord Balaram visited the broad Bindusaras lake, Chitakupa, Sudarshan, Vishal, Brahmatirtha, Chakratirtha, and the eastward flowing Saraswati. He also went to all the holy places along the Yamuna and the Ganges, and then he came to the Naimisha forest, where great sages were performing an elaborate sacrifice. Recognizing the Lord upon his arrival, the sages, who had been engaged in their sacrificial rituals for a long time, greeted him properly by standing up, bowing down, and worshipping him. After being thus worshipped along with his entourage, the Lord accepted a seat of honor. Then he noticed that Romaharshan, Vyasadeva's disciple, had remained seated. Lord Balaram became extremely angry upon seeing how this member of the Suta caste had failed to stand up, bow down, or join his palms, and also how he was sitting above all the learned Brahmins. Lord Balaram said, "Because this fool born from an improperly mixed marriage sits above all these Brahmins and even above me, the protector of religion, he deserves to die. Although he is a disciple of the divine sage Vyas and has thoroughly learned many scriptures from him, including the law books of religious duties and the epic histories and Puranas, all this study has not produced good qualities in him. Rather, his study of the scriptures is like an actor studying his part, for he is not self-controlled or humble, and vainly presumes himself a scholarly authority, though he has failed to conquer his own mind. The very purpose of my descent into this world is to kill such hypocrites who pretend to be religious. Indeed, they are the most sinful rascals." Although Lord Balaram had stopped killing the impious, Romaharshan's death was inevitable. Thus, having spoken, the Lord killed him by picking up a blade of kusha grass and touching him with its tip. All the sages cried out, "Alas, alas!" in great distress. They told Lord Sankarshan, "O master, you have committed an irreligious act. O favorite of the Yadus, we gave him the seat of the spiritual master and promised him long life and freedom from physical pain for as long as this sacrifice continues. You have unknowingly killed a Brahmin. Of course, even the injunctions of revealed scripture cannot dictate to you, the Lord of all mystic power. But if by your own free will you nonetheless carry out the prescribed purification for this slaying of a Brahmin, O purifier of the whole world, people in general will greatly benefit by your example." The Personality of Godhead said, "I will certainly perform the atonement for this killing, since I wish to show compassion to the people in general. Please, therefore, prescribe for me whatever ritual is to be done first. O sages, just say the word, and by my mystic power I shall restore everything you promised him, long life, strength, and sensory power." The sages said, "Please see to it, O Rama, that your power and that of the Kusha weapon, as well as our promise and Romaharshan's death, all remain intact." The Supreme Lord said, "The Vedas instruct us that one's own self takes birth again as one's son. Thus let Romaharshan's son become the speaker of the Puranas, and let him be endowed with long life, strong senses, and stamina." Please tell me your desire, O best of sages, and I shall certainly fulfill it. And, O wise souls, please carefully determine my proper atonement, since I do not know what it might be. The sages said, A fearsome demon named Balvala, the son of Ilvala, comes here every new moon day and contaminates our sacrifice. O descendant of the Sharha, please kill that sinful demon who pours down pus, blood, feces, urine, wine, and meat upon us. This is the best service you can do for us. Thereafter, for 12 months, you should circumambulate the land of Bharata in a mood of serious meditation, executing austerities and bathing at various holy pilgrimage sites. In this way, you will become purified. Chapter 79, Lord Balaram Goes on Pilgrimage. Shukadev Goswami said, Then, on the new moon day, a fierce and frightening wind arose, scattering dust all about and spreading the smell of pus everywhere. Next, onto the sacrificial arena came a downpour of abominable things sent by Balvala, after which the demon himself appeared, trident in hand. The immense demon resembled a mass of black carbon. His topknot and beard were like molten copper, and his face had horrible fangs and furrowed eyebrows. Upon seeing him, Lord Balaram thought of his club, which tears to pieces his enemy's armies, and his plow weapon, which punishes the demons. Thus summoned, his two weapons appeared before him at once. With the tip of his plow, Lord Balaram caught hold of the demon Balvala as he flew through the sky, and with his club, the Lord angrily struck that harasser of Brahmins on the head. Balvala cried out in agony and fell to the ground, his forehead cracked open and gushing blood. He resembled a red mountain struck by a lightning bolt. The exalted sages honored Lord Rama with sincere prayers and awarded him infallible blessings. Then they performed his ritual bath, just as the demigods had formerly bathed Indra when he killed Dhritra. They gave Lord Balaram a Vaijayanti garland of unfading lotuses in which resided the goddess of fortune, and they also gave him a set of divine garments and jewelry. Then, given leave by the sages, the Lord went with a contingent of Brahmins to the Kaushiki River, where he bathed. From there he went to the lake from which flows the river Sarayu. The Lord followed the course of the Sarayu until he came to Prayag, where he bathed and then performed rituals to propitiate the demigods and other living beings. Next he went to the ashram of Pulaha Rishi. Lord Balaram bathed in the Gomati, Gandaki, and Vipasha rivers, and also immersed himself in the Shona. He went to Gaya, where he worshipped his forefathers, and to the mouth of the Ganges, where he performed purifying ablutions. At Mount Mahindra, he saw Lord Parashuram and offered him prayers, and then he bathed in the 7 branches of the Godavari River, and also in the rivers Vena, Pampa, and Bhimarati. Then Lord Balaram met Lord Skanda and visited Sri Shaila, the abode of Lord Girisha. In the southern provinces known as Dravidadesh, the Supreme Lord saw the sacred Venkata Hill, as well as the cities of Kamakoshni and Kanchi, the exalted Kaveri River, and the most holy Sri Ranga, where Lord Krishna has manifested himself. From there he went to Rishabha Mountain, where Lord Krishna also lives, and to the southern Mathura. Then he came to Setubandha, where the most grievous sins are destroyed. There at Setubandha, Lord Balaram gave Brahmins 10,000 cows in charity. He then visited the Kritamala and Tamraparni rivers and the great Malaya mountains. In the Malaya range, Lord Balaram found Agastya Rishi sitting in meditation. After bowing down to the sage, the Lord offered him prayers and then received blessings from him. Taking leave from Agastya, he proceeded to the shore of the southern ocean, where he saw Goddess Durga in her form of Kanyakumari. Next, he went to Palgun Tirtha and bathed in the sacred Panchapsara lake, where Lord Vishnu had directly manifested himself. At this place, he gave away another 10,000 cows. The Supreme Lord then traveled through the kingdoms of Kerala and Trigarta, visiting Lord Shiva's sacred city of Gokarna, where Lord Shiva directly manifests himself. After also visiting Goddess Parvati, who dwells on an island, Lord Balaram went to the holy district of Shurparaka and bathed in the Tapi, Payoshni, and near Vindhya rivers. He next entered the Dandaka forest and went to the river Reva, along which the city of Mahishmati is found. Then he bathed at Manutirtha and finally returned to Prabhas. The Lord heard from Brahmins how all the kings involved in the battle taking place between the Kurus and Pandavas had been killed. From this, he concluded that the earth was now relieved of her burden. Wanting to stop the club fight then raging between Bhima and Duryodhana on the battlefield, Lord Balaram went to Kurukshetra. When Yudhisthira, Lord Krishna, Arjuna, and the twin brothers Nakula and Sahadev saw Lord Balaram, they offered him respectful obeisances but said nothing, thinking, "What has he come here to tell us?" Lord Balaram found Duryodhana and Bhima with clubs in their hands, each furiously striving for victory over the other as they circled about skillfully. The Lord addressed them as follows, "King Duryodhana and Bhima, listen. You two warriors are equal in fighting prowess. I know that one of you has greater physical power, while the other is better trained in technique. Since you are so evenly matched in fighting prowess, I do not see how either of you can win or lose this duel. Therefore, please stop this useless battle." They did not accept Lord Balaram's request, O King, although it was logical, for their mutual enmity was irrevocable. Each of them constantly remembered the insults and injuries he had suffered from the other. Concluding that the battle was the arrangement of fate, Lord Balaram went back to Dwaraka. There he was greeted by Ugrasen and his other relatives, who were all delighted to see him. Later, Lord Balaram returned to Naimasharanya, where the sages joyfully engaged him, the embodiment of all sacrifice, in performing various kinds of Vedic sacrifice. Lord Balaram was now retired from warfare. The all-powerful Lord Balaram bestowed upon the sages pure spiritual knowledge by which they could see the whole universe within him and also see him pervading everything. After executing with his wife the Avavritya ablutions, the beautifully dressed and ornamented Lord Balaram, encircled by his immediate family and other relatives and friends, looked as splendid as the moon surrounded by its effulgent rays. Countless other such pastimes were performed by mighty Balaram, the unlimited and immeasurable Supreme Lord, whose mystic Yogamaya power makes him appear to be a human being. All the activities of the unlimited Lord Balaram are amazing. Anyone who regularly remembers them at dawn and dusk will become very dear to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Vishnu. Chapter 80, The Brahman Sudama Visits Lord Krishna in Dwaraka. King Parikshit said, "My Lord, O Master, I wish to hear about other valorous deeds performed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Mukunda, whose valor is unlimited. O Brahman, how could anyone who knows the essence of life and is disgusted with endeavoring for sense gratification give up the transcendental topics of Lord Krishna after hearing them repeatedly? Actual speech is that which describes the qualities of the Lord. Real hands are those that work for him. A true mind is that which always remembers him dwelling within everything moving and non-moving. And actual ears are those that listen to sanctifying topics about him. An actual head is one that bows down to the Lord in his manifestations among the moving and non-moving creatures. Real eyes are those that see only the Lord. And actual limbs are those which regularly honor the water that has bathed the Lord's feet or those of his devotees." Sutta Goswami said, "Thus questioned by King Vishnurata, the powerful sage Bhadarayani replied, his heart fully absorbed in meditation on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudev." Shukadev Goswami said, "Lord Krishna had a certain Brahmin friend named Sudama, who was most learned in Vedic knowledge and detached from all sense enjoyment. Furthermore, his mind was peaceful and his senses subdued. Living as a householder, he maintained himself with whatever came of its own accord. The wife of that poorly dressed Brahmin suffered along with him and was emaciated from hunger. The chaste wife of the poverty-stricken Brahmin once approached him, her face dried up because of her distress. Trembling with fear, she spoke as follows, 'O Brahmin, isn't it true that the husband of the goddess of fortune is the personal friend of your exalted self? That greatest of Yadavas, the Supreme Lord Krishna, is compassionate to Brahmins and very willing to grant them his shelter. O fortunate one, please approach him, the real shelter of all saints. He will certainly give abundant wealth to such a suffering householder as you. Lord Krishna is now the ruler of the Bhojas, Vrishnis, and Andakas, and is staying at Dwaraka. Since he gives even his own self to anyone who simply remembers his lotus feet, What doubt is there that he, the spiritual master of the universe, will bestow upon his sincere worshiper prosperity and material enjoyment, which are not even very desirable? When his wife thus repeatedly implored him in various ways, the Brahman thought to himself, "To see Lord Krishna is indeed the greatest achievement in life." Thus he decided to go, but first he told her, "My good wife, if there is anything in the house I can bring as a gift, please give it to me." Sudama's wife begged 4 handfuls of flat rice from neighboring Brahmins, tied up the rice in a torn piece of cloth, and gave it to her husband as a present for Lord Krishna. Taking the flat rice, the saintly Brahmin set off for Dwarka, all the while wondering, "How will I be able to have Krishna's audience?" The learned Brahmin, joined by some local Brahmins, passed 3 guard stations and went through 3 gateways, and then he walked by the homes of Lord Krishna's faithful devotees, the Yundakas and Vrishnis, which ordinarily no one could do. He then entered one of the opulent palaces belonging to Lord Hari's 16,000 queens, and when he did so, he felt as if he were attaining the bliss of liberation. At that time, Lord Achyuta was seated on his consort's bed. Spotting the Brahmin at some distance, the Lord immediately stood up, went forward to meet him, and with great pleasure embraced him. The lotus-eyed Supreme Lord felt intense ecstasy upon touching the body of his dear friend, the wise Brahmin, and thus he shed tears of love. Lord Krishna seated his friend Sudama upon the bed. Then the Lord, who purifies the whole world, personally offered him various tokens of respect and washed his feet, after which he sprinkled the water on his own head. Krishna anointed him with divinely fragrant sandalwood, aguru, and kumkum pastes, and happily worshipped him with aromatic incense and arrays of lamps. After finally offering him betel nut and the gift of a cow, he welcomed him with pleasing words. By fanning him with her chamara, the divine goddess of fortune personally served that poor Brahmin, whose clothing was torn and dirty, and who was so thin that veins were visible all over his body. The people in the royal palace were astonished to see Krishna, the Lord of spotless glory, so lovingly honor this shabbily dressed Brahmin. The residents of the palace said, "What pious acts has this unkempt, impoverished Brahmin performed? People regard him as lowly and contemptible, yet the spiritual master of the 3 worlds, the abode of Goddess Sri, is serving him reverently. Leaving the goddess of fortune sitting on her bed, the Lord has embraced this Brahmin as if he were an older brother." Taking each other's hands, O King, Krishna and Sudama talked pleasantly about how they once lived together in the school of their guru. The Supreme Lord said, "My dear Brahmin, you know well the ways of Dharma. After you offered the gift of remuneration to our guru and returned home from his school, did you marry a compatible wife or not? Even though you are mostly involved in household affairs, your mind is not affected by material desires. Nor, O learned one, do you take much pleasure in the pursuit of material wealth. This I am well aware of. Having renounced all material propensities which spring from the Lord's illusory energy, some people execute worldly duties with their minds undisturbed by mundane desires. They act as I do, to instruct the general populace. My dear Brahmin, do you remember how we lived together in our spiritual master's school? When a twice-born student has learned from his guru all that is to be learned, he can enjoy spiritual life, which lies beyond all ignorance. My dear friend, he who gives a person his physical birth is his first spiritual master, and he who initiates him as a twice-born Brahmin and engages him in religious duties is indeed more directly his spiritual master. But the person who bestows transcendental knowledge upon the members of all the spiritual orders of society is one's ultimate spiritual master. Indeed, he is as good as my own self. Certainly, O Brahmin, of all the followers of the Varnashram system, those who take advantage of the words I speak in my form as the spiritual master, and thus easily cross over the ocean of material existence, best understand their own true welfare. I, the soul of all beings, am not as satisfied by ritual worship, brahminical initiation, penances, or self-discipline, as I am by faithful service rendered to one's spiritual master. O Brahmin, do you remember what happened to us while we were living with our spiritual master? Once, our guru's wife sent us to fetch firewood, and after we entered the vast forest, an unseasonal storm arose, with fierce wind and rain and harsh thunder. Then, as the sun set, the forest was covered by darkness in every direction, and with all the flooding we could not distinguish high land from low. Constantly besieged by the powerful wind and rain, we lost our way amidst the flooding waters. We simply held each other's hands, and in great distress wandered aimlessly about the forest. Our guru, Sandipani, understood our predicament, set out after sunrise to search for us, his disciples, and found us in distress. Sandipani said, "Oh, my children, you have suffered so much for my sake. The body is most dear to every living creature, but you are so dedicated to me that you completely disregarded your own comfort. This indeed is the duty of all true disciples, to repay the debt to their spiritual master by offering him, with pure hearts, their wealth and even their very lives. You boys are first-class Brahmins, and I am satisfied with you. May all your desires be fulfilled, and may the Vedic mantras you have learned never lose their meaning for you, in this world or the next." Lord Krishna continued, "We had many similar experiences while living in our spiritual master's home. Simply by the grace of the spiritual master, a person can fulfill life's purpose and attain eternal peace." Sudama said, "What could I possibly have failed to achieve, O Lord of Lords, O Universal Teacher, since I was able to personally live with you, whose every desire is fulfilled, at the home of our spiritual master? O Almighty Lord, your body comprises the absolute truth in the form of the Vedas and is thus the source of all auspicious goals of life. That you took up residence at the school of a spiritual master is simply one of your pastimes in which you play the role of a human being." Chapter 81. The Lord Blesses Sudama Brahman. Shukadeva Goswami said, "Lord Krishna perfectly knows the hearts of all living beings, and he is especially devoted to the Brahmins. While the Lord conversed in this way with the best of the twice-born, he laughed and spoke the following words to that dear friend of his, the Brahmin Sudama, all the while smiling and looking upon him with affection. The Supreme Lord said, 'O Brahmin, what gift have you brought me from home? I regard as great even the smallest gift offered by my devotees in pure love, but even great offerings presented by non-devotees do not please me. If one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or water, I will accept it.' Even after being addressed in this way, O King, the Brahmin felt too embarrassed to offer his palmfuls of flat rice to the husband of the goddess of fortune. He simply kept his head bowed in shame. Being the direct witness in the hearts of all living beings, Lord Krishna fully understood why Sudama had come to see him. Thus he thought, 'In the past, my friend has never worshipped me out of a desire for material opulence, but now he comes to me to satisfy his chaste and devoted wife. I will give him riches that even the immortal demigods cannot obtain.' Thinking like this, the Lord snatched from the Brahmin's garment the grains of flat rice tied up in an old piece of cloth and exclaimed, 'What is this? My friend, have you brought this for me? It gives me extreme pleasure. Indeed, these few grains of flat rice will satisfy not only me, but also the entire universe.' After saying this, the Supreme Lord ate one palmful and was about to eat a second when the devoted goddess Rukmini took hold of his hand. Queen Rukmini said, 'This is more than enough, O soul of the universe, to secure him an abundance of all kinds of wealth in this world and the next. After all, one's prosperity depends simply on your satisfaction.' The Brahmin spent that night in Lord Achyuta's palace after eating and drinking to his full satisfaction. He felt as if he had gone to the spiritual world. The next day, Sudama set off for home while being honored by Lord Krishna, the self-satisfied maintainer of the universe. The Brahmin felt greatly delighted as he walked along the road. Although he had apparently received no wealth from Lord Krishna, Sudama was too shy to beg for it on his own. He simply returned home, feeling perfectly satisfied to have had the Supreme Lord's audience. Sudama thought, "Lord Krishna is known to be devoted to the Brahmins, and now I have personally seen this devotion. Indeed, he who carries the goddess of fortune on his chest has embraced the poorest beggar. Who am I, a sinful, poor friend of a Brahmin? And who is Krishna, the supreme personality of Godhead, full in six opulences? Nonetheless, he has embraced me with his two arms. He treated me just like one of his brothers, making me sit on the bed of his beloved consort. And because I was fatigued, his queen personally fanned me with a yak-tailed chamara. Although he is the lord of all demigods and the object of worship for all Brahmins, he worshipped me as if I were a demigod myself, massaging my feet and rendering other humble services. Devotional service to his lord be fulfilled, and may the Vedic mantras you have learned never lose their meaning for you, in this world or the next. Lord Krishna continued, we had many similar experiences while living in our spiritual master's home. Simply by the grace of the spiritual master, a person can fulfill life's purpose and attain eternal peace. Sudama said, what could I possibly have failed to achieve, O Lord of Lords, O Universal Teacher, since I was able to personally live with you, whose every desire is fulfilled, at the home of our spiritual master? O Almighty Lord, your body comprises the absolute truth in the form of the Vedas and is thus the source of all auspicious goals of life. That you took up residence at the school of a spiritual master is simply one of your pastimes in which you play the role of a human being. Chapter 81. The Lord Blesses Sudama Brahman. Shukadev Goswami said, Lord Krishna perfectly knows the hearts of all living beings, and he is especially devoted to the Brahmins. While the Lord conversed in this way with the best of the twice-born, he laughed and spoke the following words to that dear friend of his, the Brahman Sudama, all the while smiling and looking upon him with affection. The Supreme Lord said, O Brahman, what gift have you brought me from home? I regard as great even the smallest gift offered by my devotees in pure love, but even great offerings presented by non-devotees do not please me. If one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or water, I will accept it. Even after being addressed in this way, O King, the Brahmin felt too embarrassed to offer his palmfuls of flat rice to the husband of the goddess of fortune. He simply kept his head bowed in shame. Being the direct witness in the hearts of all living beings, Lord Krishna fully understood why Sudama had come to see him. Thus he thought, in the past, my friend has never worshipped me out of a desire for material opulence, but now he comes to me to satisfy his chaste and devoted wife. I will give him riches that even the immortal demigods cannot obtain. Thinking like this, the Lord snatched from the Brahmin's garment the grains of flat rice tied up in an old piece of cloth and exclaimed, what is this? My friend, have you brought this for me? It gives me extreme pleasure. Indeed, these few grains of flat rice will satisfy not only me, but also the entire universe. After saying this, the Supreme Lord ate one palmful and was about to eat a second when the devoted goddess Rukmini took hold of his hand. Queen Rukmini said, this is more than enough, O soul of the universe, to secure him an abundance of all kinds of wealth in this world and the next. After all, one's prosperity depends simply on your satisfaction. The Brahmin spent that night in Lord Achyuta's palace after eating and drinking to his full satisfaction. He felt as if he had gone to the spiritual world. The next day, Sudama set off for home while being honored by Lord Krishna, the self-satisfied maintainer of the universe. The Brahmin felt greatly delighted as he walked along the road. Although he had apparently received no wealth from Lord Krishna, Sudama was too shy to beg for it on his own. He simply returned home, feeling perfectly satisfied to have had the Supreme Lord's audience. Sudama thought, Lord Krishna is known to be devoted to the Brahmins, and now I have personally seen this devotion. Indeed, he who carries the goddess of fortune on his chest has embraced the poorest beggar. Who am I, a sinful, poor friend of a Brahmin? And who is Krishna, the supreme personality of Godhead, full in six opulences? Nonetheless, he has embraced me with his two arms. He treated me just like one of his brothers, making me sit on the bed of his beloved consort. And because I was fatigued, his queen personally fanned me with a yak-tailed chamara. Although he is the lord of all demigods and the object of worship for all Brahmins, he worshipped me as if I were a demigod myself, massaging my feet and rendering other humble services. Devotional service to his lotus feet is the root cause of all the perfections a person can find in heaven, in liberation, in the subterranean regions, and on earth. Thinking, if this poor wretch suddenly becomes rich, he will forget me in his intoxicating happiness. The compassionate Lord did not grant me even a little wealth. Thinking thus to himself, Sudama finally came to the place where his home stood. But that place was now crowded on all sides with towering celestial palaces rivaling the combined brilliance of the sun, fire, and the moon. There were splendorous courtyards and gardens, each filled with flocks of cooing birds and beautified by ponds in which Kumuda, Amboja, Kalara, and Utpala lotuses grew. Finely attired men and doe-eyed women stood in attendance. Sudama wondered, "What is all this? Whose property is it? How has this all come about?" As he continued to ponder in this way, the beautiful men and maidservants, as effulgent as demigods, came forward to greet their greatly fortunate master with loud song and instrumental music. When she heard that her husband had arrived, the Brahmin's wife quickly came out of the house in a jubilant flurry. She resembled the goddess of fortune herself emerging from her divine abode. When the chaste lady saw her husband, her eyes filled with tears of love and eagerness. As she held her eyes closed, she solemnly bowed down to him, and in her heart she embraced him. Sudama was amazed to see his wife. Shining forth in the midst of maidservants adorned with jeweled lockets, she looked as effulgent as a demigoddess in her celestial airplane. With pleasure, he took his wife with him and entered his house, where there were hundreds of gem-studded pillars, just as in the palace of Lord Mahendra. In Sudama's home were beds as soft and white as the foam of milk, with bedsteads made of ivory and ornamented with gold. There were also couches with golden legs, as well as royal chamara fans, golden thrones, soft cushions, and gleaming canopies hung with strings of pearls. Upon the walls of sparkling crystal glass, inlaid with precious emeralds, shone jeweled lamps, and the women in the palace were all adorned with precious gems. As he viewed this luxurious opulence of all varieties, the Brahmin calmly reasoned to himself about his unexpected prosperity. Sudama thought, "I have always been poor. Certainly the only possible way that such an unfortunate person as myself could become suddenly rich is that Lord Krishna, the supremely opulent chief of the Yadu dynasty, has glanced upon me. After all, my friend Krishna, the most exalted of the Disharhas and the enjoyer of unlimited wealth, noticed that I secretly intended to beg from him. Thus, even though he said nothing about it when I stood before him, he actually bestowed upon me the most abundant riches. In this way, he acted just like a merciful rain cloud. The Lord considers even his greatest benedictions to be insignificant, while he magnifies even a small service rendered to him by his well-wishing devotee. Thus, with pleasure, the Supreme Soul accepted a single palmful of the rice I brought him. The Lord is the supremely compassionate reservoir of all transcendental qualities. Life after life, may I serve him with love, friendship, and sympathy, and may I cultivate such firm attachment for him by the precious association of his devotees. To a devotee who lacks spiritual insight, the Supreme Lord will not grant the wonderful opulences of this world, kingly power, and material assets. Indeed, in his infinite wisdom, the unborn Lord well knows how the intoxication of pride can cause the downfall of the wealthy." Shukadeva Goswami continued, "Thus firmly fixing his determination by means of his spiritual intelligence, Sudama remained absolutely devoted to Lord Krishna, the shelter of all living beings. Free from avarice, he enjoyed, together with his wife, the sense pleasures that had been bestowed upon him, always with the idea of eventually renouncing all sense gratification. Lord Hari is the God of all gods, the master of all sacrifices, and the supreme ruler. But he accepts the saintly Brahmins as his masters, and so there exists no deity higher than them. Thus seeing how the unconquerable Supreme Lord is nonetheless conquered by his own servants, the Lord's dear Brahmin friend felt the remaining knots of material attachment within his heart being cut by the force of his constant meditation on the Lord. In a short time he attained Lord Krishna's supreme abode, the destination of great saints. The Lord always shows Brahmins special favor. Anyone who hears this account of the Supreme Lord's kindness to Brahmins will come to develop love for the Lord and thus become freed from the bondage of material work." Chapter 82, Krishna and Balaram meet the inhabitants of Vrindavan. Shukadeva Goswami said, "Once, while Balaram and Krishna were living in Dwaraka, there occurred a great eclipse of the sun, just as if the end of Lord Brahma's day had come. Knowing of this eclipse in advance, many people went to the holy place known as Samanta Panchaka in order to earn pious credit. After ridding the earth of kings, Lord Parashuram, the foremost of warriors, created huge lakes from the king's blood at Samantapanchaka. Although he is never tainted by karmic reactions, Lord Parashuram performed sacrifices there to instruct people in general. Thus he acted like an ordinary person trying to free himself of sins. From all parts of Bharatavarsha, a great number of people now came to that Samantapanchaka on pilgrimage. Among those arriving at the holy place were many Vrishnis, such as Gada, Prajumna, and Samba, hoping to be relieved of their sins. Akrura, Vasudev, Ahuka, and other kings also went there. Aniruddha remained in Dwaraka with Suchandra, Shuka, and Sarana to guard the city, together with Kritavarma, the commander of their armed forces. The mighty Yadavas passed with great majesty along the road. They were attended by their soldiers, who rode on chariots rivaling the airplanes of heaven, on horses moving with a rhythmic gait, and on bellowing elephants as huge as clouds. Also with them were many infantrymen as effulgent as celestial Vidyadharas. The Yadavas were so divinely dressed, being adorned with gold necklaces and flower garlands and wearing fine armor, that as they proceeded along the road with their wives, they seemed to be demigods flying through the sky. At Samantapanchaka, the saintly Yadavas bathed and then observed a fast with careful attention. Afterward, they presented Brahmins with cows bedecked with garments, flower garlands, and gold necklaces. In accordance with scriptural injunctions, the descendants of Vrishni then bathed once more in Lord Parashuram's lakes and fed first-class Brahmins with sumptuous food. All the while they prayed, "May we be granted devotion to Lord Krishna." Then, with the permission of Lord Krishna, their sole object of worship, the Vrishnis ate breakfast and sat down at their leisure beneath trees that gave cooling shade. The Yadavas saw that many of the kings who had arrived were old friends and relatives. The Matsyas, Ushinaras, Kaushalyas, Vidarbhas, Kurus, Srinjayas, Kambojas, Kaikeyas, Madras, Kuntis, and the kings of Anarta and Kerala. They also saw many hundreds of other kings, both allies and adversaries. In addition, my dear King Parikshit, they saw their dear friends Nanda Maharaj and the cowherd men and women who had been suffering in anxiety for so long. As the great joy of seeing one another made the lotuses of their hearts and faces bloom with fresh beauty, the men embraced one another enthusiastically. With tears pouring from their eyes, the hair on their bodies standing on end, and their voices choked up, they all felt intense bliss. The women glanced at one another with pure smiles of loving friendship, and when they embraced, their breasts, smeared with saffron paste, pressed against one another as their eyes filled with tears of affection. They all then offered obeisances to their elders and received respect in turn from their younger relatives. After inquiring from one another about the comfort of their trip and their well-being, they proceeded to talk about Krishna. Queen Kunti met with her brothers and sisters and their children, and also with her parents, her brothers' wives, and Lord Mukunda. While talking with them, she forgot her sorrow. Queen Kunti said, "My dear respectable brother Vasudev, I feel that my desires have been frustrated, because although all of you are most saintly, you forgot me during my calamities. Friends and family members, even children, brothers, and parents, forget a dear one whom Providence no longer favors." Sri Vasudev said, "Dear sister, please do not be angry with us. We are only ordinary men, playthings of fate. Indeed, whether a person acts on his own or is forced by others, he is always under the Supreme Lord's control. Harassed by Kamsa, we all fled in various directions, but by the grace of Providence, we have now finally been able to return to our homes, my dear sister." Shukadev Goswami said, "Vasudev, Ugrasen, and the other Yadus honored the various kings, who became supremely blissful and content upon seeing Lord Achyuta. All the royalty present, including Bhishma, Drona, Dhritarashtra, Gandhari and her sons, the Pandavas and their wives, Kunti, Sanjaya, Vidura, Kripacharya, Kunti Bhoja, Virata, Bhishmaka, the great Nagnajit, Purujit, Drupada, Shalya, Drishtaketu, Kasiraj, Dhamagosh, Vishalaksha, Maitila, Madra, Kekaya, Yudhamanyu, Susharma, Balika with his associates and their sons, and the many other kings subservient to Maharaj Yudhisthira, all of them, O best of kings, were simply amazed to see the transcendental form of Lord Krishna, the abode of all opulence and beauty, standing before them with his consorts. After Lord Balaram and Lord Krishna had liberally honored them, with great joy and enthusiasm, these kings began to praise the members of the Vrishni clan, Sri Krishna's personal associates. The king said, O King of the Bhojas, you alone among men have achieved a truly exalted birth, for you continually behold Lord Krishna, who is rarely visible even to great yogis. His fame, as broadcast by the Vedas, the water that has washed his feet, and the words he speaks in the form of the revealed scriptures, these thoroughly purify this universe. Although the earth's good fortune was ravaged by time, the touch of his lotus feet has revitalized her, and thus she is raining down on us the fulfillment of all our desires. The same Lord Vishnu who makes one forget the goals of heaven and liberation has now entered into marital and blood relationships with you, who otherwise travel on the hellish path of family life. Indeed, in these relationships you see and touch him directly, walk beside him, converse with him, and together with him lie down to rest, sit at ease, and take your meals. Shukadeva Goswami said, when Nanda Maharaj learned that the Yadus had arrived, led by Krishna, he immediately went to see them. The cowherds accompanied him, their various possessions loaded on their wagons. Seeing Nanda, the Vrishnis were delighted and stood up like dead bodies coming back to life. Having felt much distress at not seeing him for so long, they held them in a tight embrace. Vasudeva embraced Nanda Maharaj with great joy. Beside himself with ecstatic love, Vasudeva remembered the troubles Kamsa had caused him, forcing him to leave his sons in Gokula for their safety. Krishna and Balaram embraced their foster parents and bowed down to them, but their throats were so choked up with tears of love that the two lords could say nothing. Raising their two sons onto their laps and holding them in their arms, Nanda and saintly Mother Yashoda forgot their sorrow. Then Rohini and Devaki both embraced the Queen of Braja, remembering the faithful friendship she had shown them. Their throats choking with tears, they addressed her as follows. What woman could forget the unceasing friendship you and Nanda have shown us, dear Queen of Braja? There is no way to repay you in this world, even with the wealth of Indra. Before these two boys had ever seen their real parents, you acted as their parents and gave them all affectionate care, training, nourishment, and protection. They were never afraid, good lady, because you protected them just as eyelids protect the eyes. Indeed, saintly persons like you never discriminate between outsiders and their own kin. Shukadeva Goswami said, while gazing at their beloved Krishna, the young gopis used to condemn the creator of their eyelids, which would momentarily block their vision of him. Now, seeing Krishna again after such a long separation, with their eyes they took him into their hearts, and there they embraced him to their full satisfaction. In this way they became totally absorbed in ecstatic meditation upon him, although those who constantly practice mystic yoga find such absorption difficult to achieve. The Supreme Lord approached the gopis in a secluded place as they stood in their ecstatic trance. After embracing each of them and inquiring about their well-being, he laughed and spoke as follows. My dear girlfriends, do you still remember me? It was for my relative's sake that I stayed away so long, intent on destroying my enemies. Do you perhaps think I am ungrateful and thus hold me in contempt? After all, it is the Supreme Lord who brings living beings together and then separates them. Just as the wind brings together masses of clouds, blades of grass, wisps of cotton, and particles of dust, only to scatter them all again, so the Creator deals with his created beings in the same way. Rendering devotional service to me qualifies any living being for eternal life. But by your good fortune, you have developed a special loving attitude toward me, by which you have obtained me. Dear ladies, I am the beginning and end of all created beings and exist both within and without them. Just as the elements ether, water, earth, air, and fire are the beginning and end of all material objects and exist both within and without them. In this way, all created things reside within the basic elements of creation, while the spirit souls pervade the creation, remaining in their own true identity. You should see both of these, the material creation and the self, as manifest within me, the imperishable supreme truth. Shukadeva Goswami said, having thus been instructed by Krishna in spiritual matters, the gopis were freed of all tinges of false ego because of their incessant meditation upon him. And with their deepening absorption in him, they came to understand him fully. The gopis spoke thus, dear Lord, whose navel is just like a lotus flower, your lotus feet are the only shelter for those who have fallen into the deep well of material existence. Your feet are worshipped and meditated upon by great mystic yogis and highly learned philosophers. We wish that these lotus feet may also be awakened within our hearts, although we are only ordinary persons engaged in household affairs.